And here's our speaker, Margot Black.
And there's a clock there on the wall. Yeah, and you can go to 20 minutes, 25 after.
Okay, thank you. Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for having me here today. My name is Margot Black, and as said, I'm one of the founders of Portland Tenants United, a tenants' rights group that is using direct action to organize tenants in their homes and in their communities to fight for housing stability and housing dignity for everyone, based on the premise and belief that tenants' rights are civil rights and housing is a human right. And we're also fighting in the halls of power to make policy change at the same time as, you know, just fighting in our communities to affect better living conditions. When I was asked to speak, thank you very much for asking me to speak, I checked in with Matthias. And he said something about making it sort of spiritual. I have to tell you that I was actually raised in the Unitarian Church in Salt Lake City, Utah, where I was very much in the minority as a Unitarian there, and to be not Mormon in Salt Lake is sort of a weird place to be. It's actually to be like anti-Mormon, and which is sad. And so there's this kind of rejection of spirituality. And so when I moved to Oregon, I kind of shed all of that. And I thought, I don't even know how to channel that vibe anymore. So I'm just gonna do the best I can. Plus I spend a lot of time doing agitational speaking. So I feel like as long as I can balance it between, you know, spiritual and agitational, maybe hold your attention. So I was asked to share a little bit about my personal story and how that brought me to my work, which is actually not at all unrelated to my being raised in the Unitarian Church. I'm going to start sort of at the present and then very quickly rewind. My mother is mentally ill. She suffers from a very acute case of schizophrenia and psychosis. She's been institutionalized most of my life. She is currently federally incarcerated in Texas in I think one of the only women's prisons that has psychiatric care. And this is a fairly recent development. In the last few years, she was in transitional housing after a very long stint in the Utah State Hospital, what we call supportive housing for folks who have mental health issues and who need a lot of care and resources to, you know, eat and maintain their lives. And given the nature of her mental illness, she's, you know, want to do things that are not always legal. And she called a federal judge and made some threats. Not a federal judge she'd ever been in front of before or anything. After a couple of phone calls, the judge said, we need to make sure that this is not a credible threat. And the federal marshals came in and very quickly realized it was not a credible threat. This was a woman suffering from profound mental illness who was, you know, probably heard about this judge on the TV. But in her supportive housing, as soon as the federal marshals came in, they said, thank goodness, this is just the excuse we need to kick her out, because she is a royal pain, and she really is. And I mean that with love, but I mean, you know, people who have profound mental illness are very hard to take care of. And when I spoke with the federal marshals, they said, you know, we really don't want to press charges. She's clearly not a threat to this judge, and she clearly was not acting from a place of competency, but no one else will take her. And the alternative is homelessness. And so that is why she is federally incarcerated, is because that is how we take care of our mentally ill community members who cannot have, where they've exhausted all other options. So that is my now. And so as I think about sort of the broad spectrum of housing justice, even though I have my good health and my family is healthy and I draw from a lot of sources of privilege, the extremely vulnerable and the challenges of housing them is not far from my heart and head. Because of my mom's mental illness, I spent a lot of my early childhood in a VW bus, camping on the beach in Oregon, Washington, in hostels and in foster care. I was eventually stabilized with my very loving, wonderful grandmother in a kind of the quintessential like white picket fence home. I didn't have the white picket fence, but like everything else was there. All the neighbors whose names I knew and who, you know, we all took care of each other, they all still live there. You know, we could walk to the school, the library, the grocery store down the street and buy penny candy. It really is, when I think about sort of the challenges of being, you know, of being raised as the daughter of my mother, without knowing my biological father, I think you know, having that housing stability and that very quality housing in a very quality, livable, wonderful neighborhood is sort of key and formative to what was able to build my confidence and self-worth and self-esteem. that being said, I didn't defy all the statistics. I left home at 18 as a pregnant teenager and moved to Portland, Oregon with my boyfriend. And shortly after, so we moved in the summer, and I had my baby in December, and then in the 6 months following, my grandmother died. Then my boyfriend and I broke up. He took my car. Then I got a no-cause eviction and had to move far away, which meant I had to leave my childcare and the walking distance job I had. And so then I lost my job. And I was just on this cycle of poverty where I was I just remember this moment of trying to figure out how I could possibly get back on my feet. And I want to say something about the no-cause eviction because it's something that we are fighting really hard for right now in Portland, to end in Portland, to end statewide. And so my own personal story of getting this no-cause eviction in 1998, this is back when we didn't have a housing crisis, or at least certainly wasn't making news every day, right? I think it's really important for us to realize that, you know, people of color and other vulnerable members of our community have been experiencing our housing crisis since, you know, we colonized Oregon. and you know, and certainly for the last, you know, 100 years. I paid all my rent on time. I was friends with my neighbors. I was friends with the on-site managers. I even got my full security deposit back. You know, I had took care of my apartment. The on-site managers thought that a coworker who was bringing me home was my boyfriend and made a comment about it, and that sort of unsavoriness of having a new boyfriend as a single mom, and that being the reason that they gave me no-cause eviction. And whether he's my boyfriend or not, it's irrelevant. That's not a reason to evict somebody. And I tell this story because as we're hearing about no-cause evictions right now so much in the media, one of the talking points from the landlord lobby, if you will, is that there's always a cause. You know, this idea that no-cause evictions are needed to get rid of problem tenants and that this is easier than the for-cause eviction process. And while sometimes that may be true, we have to really remember that when you don't need to give a reason, you don't need to give a reason, and there doesn't need to be a reason, and there doesn't need to be a good reason. And you can evict a 19-year-old recently orphaned single mother who has done nothing wrong because you disagree with her lifestyle. And we shouldn't be allowed to do that. I mean, it really is a miscarriage of justice when we can do that. And so I always feel like I have to tell more of that story when I say I got a no-cause eviction, because I know, and I read it in the comment section of, you know, the Willamette Week, when my story was told, you know, there must be more to the story. She must have done something to deserve that no-cause eviction. And we get into that headspace where we try to justify bad things happening to good people and convince ourselves that they must have done something to deserve it. And I think as members of the faith community and as practitioners of social justice, we have to really question that narrative when we want to justify to ourselves an injustice that has taken, that has been imposed on someone else. So my ship was righted after that, no cause eviction. I moved to Hillsborough, lost my job. A dear friend who was the RE director for the Unitarian Church in Salt Lake City had moved to Portland at the same time, and he was an engineer at Intel, and he and I became friends. He was actually, we were in two different congregations in Salt Lake, but became friends when we moved up here. And he had this four-bedroom house in Cedar Hills, and he only was using, you know, one bedroom, and he said, you know, Margo, I sure have a lot of space that I don't need, and you sure need space and security, and why don't you come stay with me for a little while? And he let me stay there for 4 years. And let me tell you what 4 years of secure, stable housing in a safe community where you're not, you know, worried and counting every single dollar to pay the rent and trying to figure out, you know, how to, like, well, if I pay this bill on this day and get paid on that day and then, you know, try, I hope the check doesn't go through until that day, that maybe maybe everything will work out this month, when you're not playing that game, when you're living on, you know, minimum wage or less, it is transformative. And it's what, you know, middle class families largely can offer their children, whether those children have had their own children or not, as was the case with me. But for me, I didn't have those middle-class parents to be able to take me in, and fortunately, I had you know, an angel from the Unitarian Church who took me in and let me live with him rent-free for 4 years, let my daughter and I live with him. And it was the reason I was able to go to college, and I went to college, and I went to graduate school, and I got a master's degree, and I got married. There's my husband in the back, and hung out in Eugene while he got his PhD. And when I think about what made that possible, and I look at the single moms in Portland today who are working, you know, two jobs and still can't pay their rent, and when they are forced out, there's nowhere for them to go, and they're pushed away from their churches and their families and their neighbors and their childcare and their jobs, and into neighborhoods where they can't get to work because they can't get to buses. I just think, you know, I think about what it took for me to be able to transcend, and how there's just no way. There's no way that I could have done what I did and go to college and finish college and go to graduate school and finish graduate school and now have this great job as a math teacher at Lewis and Clark College without having that housing security. So when my husband and I moved back to Portland after a 1 year teaching assistant or visiting professorship in Canada, we spent a lot of time trying to find a house here to rent. While we would save and buy a house. And for me, as somebody who had just, you know, always lived in this fringe of desperately wanting to be normal and like everybody else, you know, I didn't have a father growing up. My mother was mentally ill. I had this weird backstory. Then I got pregnant, you know. And so this buying it, you know, I got married. I'm like, yes, I did that thing. Graduated from college, did that thing. And now, like, buying a home would be like the trifecta. I could be like, I did it. Like, I defeated all the stereotypes and the stigmas. So we came and we looked really, we came down from Canada 5 times looking for a house to rent, so that we could save to buy a house. And we'd had to move a few times through the PhD transition. And with little kids now, I had my 13-year-old daughter, my 13-year-old brother. There was a little twist in there. My mom had a baby right after I did, and after my grandmother died. It was crazy. Anyway, so I had my 13-year-old brother, my 13-year-old daughter, and now I had two little boys. And so we moved. So we found this place in Maplewood, and it was wonderful. And I had my dream job, and he was working as a visiting professor. And there was this moment where I was like, we arrived, like, we did it. Like, we're in this great neighborhood. We finally have careers. He's also from very humble beginnings, so buying a house for us meant saving every dollar and probably liquidating our little meager employment provided retirement program. And we were still kind of, you know, in the years post-housing crisis where home prices were a little lower than they'd been in 2008. It was 2011. And I had a conversation with the landlady at the end of the, toward the end of the year, and she said, oh, I'll renew your lease. I'm not going to raise your rent. We'll even get rid of the property management company because they're worthless. And we planned our very first, like, ever, like, family vacation, and we put in a garden in the backyard and registered my son for kindergarten, and then we got a 30-day notice to move because the owner's daughter had dropped out of law school and needed a place to live. And she said, you know, I should just get her an apartment. She doesn't need 3,000 square feet, but God, getting an apartment is so hard. I said, tell me about it. And so I had my four children, and well, you know, my three children plus my brother, and a dog and a cat, and 30 days to find a place. And it wiped us out. And I was so devastated and so frustrated. And when I, you know, I asked the owner just for one more month, we just have one more month to be able to go on our family vacation and try to find a place. And she said no. And she said that I shouldn't be so upset because I was just a renter. And even though it's pretty hard to, you know, make a claim that I deserved her home more than her daughter deserved her home, I understand the you know, the qualms with that. But being called just a renter and that as just a renter, it was sort of okay, if, you know, to just move me around like used furniture, and the whatever financial and emotional devastation that would have on my family was, so, you know, I was supposed to just accept that because I hadn't like bought a house yet. And for various reasons, in the next year or two, buying a house just became out of reach, you know, not unrelated to the unexpected move and the financial drain that had on our very small, you know, margin. And then, of course, the housing market recovered, and houses that were $300,000 were now $400,000. And so I started to really, and part of that, in there, I downsized. We downsized to an apartment to try to save some money to buy a house. And when we moved into an apartment, we got a lot of people saying, oh, I'm sorry, what happened? And it made me realize how we have this kind of perception of people who live in apartments, and especially with families. And as I get older and sort of more established, and people just find out that I don't own a house at all, they say, what happened? Like I've failed at adulting somehow. And when I complain about the rent being too high and the injustice of no-cause evictions and everything else, people say, just buy a house. And that is sort of the ticket out, right? You know, it's a ticket out of the can I say hell here? Hell that is renting. But it's not a ticket that is accessible to everyone. It's a ticket that is really only available to, you know, people of a certain class privilege, and you know, there's some luck and hard work involved as well. But you know, we don't design cities for everyone to own homes. It's actually not healthy urban planning for everyone to own homes. And it shouldn't be the only way to achieve housing security and housing stability. It shouldn't be the only thing that entitles you to a claim to your community and a claim, you know, to your city and to your neighborhood and to your block. And I really just kind of started to perseverate on this idea that somehow whatever hurdles you could jump through to buy a house, that somehow entitled you to being treated better, and to just, you know, having more self-worth and more stake in your neighborhood. People, you know, have said that renters shouldn't be allowed to vote because we vote for, you know, bond measures that end up going and raising property taxes, and those get passed on to us. And since we don't own property, we shouldn't, you know, we shouldn't vote. We shouldn't be allowed to serve in our neighborhood associations. We shouldn't have any say in school boundary decisions. You know, there is this perception, you know, this renter versus homeowner class division that just doesn't make sense. And not only does it not make sense, but it leaves our vulnerable folks, those who can't buy homes or who for very good reasons choose not to, it leaves them even more vulnerable So Matthew Desmond is coming on March 9th. He wrote, he's a Harvard sociologist and MacArthur Genius Grant Award recipient, I believe. He wrote the book Evicted, which is the Multnomah County Everybody Reads book. And his research, which is rather groundbreaking, has shown that evictions are not a consequence of poverty. Okay, so when you hear somebody got evicted, you're not, we think, oh, well, they should have made better choices in life, or they, you know, surely needed to work harder, or, you know, save money better, whatever. You know, we have all this justification for this injustice that we have somehow found ourselves absolved from. Eviction is not a consequence of poverty, it is a cause of poverty. Every time someone is forced from their home through no choice of their own, that destabilization is so profound that they lose ground, that they can't recover. And, you know, and I experienced that myself in 1998 and was only able to recover that ground by virtue of someone, you know, catching me in their net and putting me in a stable house for 4 years. And most of us do not have that that luck or privilege or whatever it is. So that is what, doing time check. That is what brought me to this work. What really did the trick, where I really said, oh my gosh, you know, something needs to be done, was a woman who had triplets and had a brand new baby and had gotten a no-cause eviction with her brand new baby. And it seemed to be very clear that actually she was being no-cause evicted because of the brand new baby. Like, the landlord saw the baby, and then, like, literally, like, when she walked out of her door that night, she had the no-cause eviction notice on her door. And I tried, this was 2 years ago, and I tried to get her some help. Knowing that, you know, when I was 19 and had gotten what was probably a discriminatory no-cause eviction, which is technically against the law, but very hard to fight, but of course what 19-year-old knows what those laws are and has the resources and wherewithal to find the justice needed to defend it. So here I am now, older and high-level executive functioning skills and on a mission, and I'm trying to find this woman legal help, just a lawyer to talk to her and tell her what her options are. And I had to make like 30 phone calls and, you know, exhaust all of my networks. And like I said, this was a couple years ago. Now I've got a few more direct lines in the work I do. But I couldn't get her help. You know, I couldn't even get her like a free 15-minute consultation with an attorney to tell her what her rights were. And I thought, this is awful that this woman is being, and her husband and their kids were being displaced. They have still not rehoused. They are still living with her grandmother, and in the summer they camp in the backyard because there's not enough room. And in the winter they cycle, but you know, some of the family sleeps in the car and some of the family sleeps on the couch. And that is how they are housing themselves, and through an eviction that probably should never have even taken place. And so this is what brought me to the work, is just these how destabilizing it is for families and what it means for these kids to grow up in this housing instability. And that when we do judge our, you know, the adults for either having not bought a house yet or who are living in tents on the street or doorways on the street, and think about all the different choices they should have made in life, and all the problems that are just perpetuating their situation, whether it's drug and alcohol abuse or mental illness or whatever, we don't think about how their story started when they were babies and when they were, you know, kids, and how many times did they have to move and why, and how many couches did they have to sleep on and cars did they have to sleep in. And so when we really think about, you know, taking care of our housing crisis, we've got to think about the impact on families and kids staying in stable housing and the transformative reward to those families and those children and our society and community as a whole when everybody has a stable home. When I think about everything confronting the world right now with the president, I can't even say his name, and how scary that is, and that the threat that brings to immigrants and refugees and people of color and the LGBTQ community and everyone who is reliant on their healthcare plan and women's rights and just everything, right? And I think about how important it is for us to have the reserves to fight and keep fighting and not stop until we win, you know, because we are under such an incredible assault as a nation. And I think about how hard it is for the people who really need to fight the hardest, because they are at the, you know, the most vulnerable, when the earth is moving beneath their feet, when they don't know where they're going to sleep at night, when they don't know if where they are now is where they're going to be next month or next year, when they can't get to know their neighbors, when they don't know if they should go to the church down the street because they don't know if that's going to be their community for very long. And when they have to validate, you know, when I have to tell people why I'm a renter and haven't bought a house and sort of explain this whole life story, because certainly there must be a story, otherwise someone like me would own a house, you know, when we're sort of demanding that level of validation to show why you should still take me seriously and still count me as, you know, a worthy member of society, then we're messing up. And we're not giving people the tools that they need to survive, you know. Maslow's hierarchy of needs, the bottom level is food and shelter, right? I mean, if we don't have that, we cannot climb up that triangle to self-actualization. Somewhere in the middle there is, you know, fighting for social justice. And you can't do that if you can't eat and you don't have a place to sleep, right? So, I don't know how spiritual that was. But that's how Portland Tenants, that's at least how I came to the Portland Tenants United table. And we are just unapologetically agitational in our work, because we just feel like we need profound change and we need it right away, and we can't equivocate. And as we do try to find that middle ground where we're still living in a land that is founded on property rights and land ownership, and as we try to find middle ground that doesn't fundamentally change those rights, we really try to just orient ourselves towards protecting the tenants, toward making sure that that housing comes first, housing stability comes first, that a roof over our heads in livable communities is the number one priority. And we need to shift, I believe, as a society and as folks fighting for a better world, we need to really shift our values from, you know, having our own vehicle for wealth creation and transfer through our own home and land ownership, to recognizing the value to society for everyone, not to have that wealth creation tool of home and land ownership, but housing stability as a wealth creation tool for our community, and what that lends to our community and how it encourages neighbors to take care of each other and trust each other and look out for each other in these times, these dark times when we need each other the most. So, thanks.
My feet are asleep. Whoa.